Mistweeted on the McFuture podcast starts right now. Let's talk about culture, media, and free speech. I tried to come up with a snappy title for this section and I couldn't. So if you have an idea, please feel free to email me. I think this is an important category because so much is going on right now, especially with people out of work, especially with the pandemic. These are the moments where we lose liberties. And this is what happened in 2008 when the stock market crashed and all kinds of laws were put in place for financial institutions and so on. That's what happened after 9/11 when surveillance of the entire population kicked in. In these moments, it's important to be diligent, especially with how important all of these digital tools are and how bad it's gotten. There's so little trust in general and some distrust that's well earned. So why did so many people want a Joe Rogan moderated debate? Someone floated this. I think it was a guest on a show and then it sort of went semi-viral. Who even knows what viral means anymore? But the reasons for that is mainstream media has failed. It's a distrusted charade. It's a bunch of talking heads performing their little play with no intention of listening to each other, no intention of coming to a resolution or a compromise. These are clowns. They are clowns that fill up a lot of airspace, but don't actually report the news. Because the actual news would probably take half hour, an hour, maybe 2 hours, and then they'd be dark for 22 hours. But no, they have to fill all of that time with a bunch of nonsense people to try to entertain us, or you have a bunch of companies that are trying to clickbait you, or creating stories, you know, some witch hunt where they're trying to cancel somebody, and that becomes a thing, and they think they're doing the right thing, but at the end of the day, that company is just capitalizing on their stupidity to get clicks. Also, these short choreographed debates with these stiff reporters playing gotcha and the candidates delivering their scripted sound bites is so unenlightening. It is the farthest thing from information or insight. This is one of those elections where you know what you're getting, right? You got two bad grandpas and you've got to decide between them. And most people have already decided, so there's not a lot of convincing. But in general, you want to let the conversation breathe. You want to have it be natural and you want to give them the opportunity to screw up. So these long conversations, they expose levels of depth or the lack thereof. So if someone is vapid and empty, a long conversation will expose that. I guarantee it. A bunch of people were praising this interview that I think it was a New Zealand reporter did with Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who I guess she was the press secretary for Trump. I watched the interview. It was like 15 minutes. And it was all gotcha questions. It was just an excuse for this woman to go, well, when you lied this time, or, you know, when the president is always lying, look, that may be true. But when you're confrontational, what that does is it causes people to clench up. They get their sphincter shuts tight. And guess what happens? They give you nothing. They feel uncomfortable. They feel defensive. And they're only going to go through their talking points. And no matter what you ask, you're going to get the bare minimum because they're never going to open up to you in any meaningful way. And not even accidentally, because they're on high alert at all times. And this is the worst interview style on earth. It just maybe feels good to you. It's like, oh, she gave it to her. And what was learned? Nothing. And this is why Joe Rogan's long form conversations are trouncing this stupidity. Because for the first time ever, you get to hear how influential people think in depth. There's no time constraints, and it's just a revelation. It's like, oh, wow, this is really interesting. And people don't mind getting deeper and deeper into these subjects. And it's no wonder that mainstream hacks are trying to always cancel Rogan because he is a threat, and honesty is a threat to them. Anything that resembles truth is a threat because they want to control your truth. And that's not a conspiracy theory. It's obvious from watching these shows how manipulated these stories are, what they ask and don't ask, what they show and don't show. It is all editorialized. And so when you have someone like Joe, and he's not the only one, even at some point Howard Stern did it, but Howard didn't really tackle any really deep, profound issues. He talked to a lot of celebrities. But Joe talks to scientists, he talks to politicians, and this is the other reason that mainstream media is scared of him. They're scared because he will have the people he wants on, and he won't have the people he doesn't care about. So he had Bernie Sanders, Tulsi Gabbard, and I think Andrew Yang. But he didn't have all these other mainstream people. And that drives the DNC and CNN and all the people who are in bed together. It drives them crazy because here's a guy who's saying no to them. He doesn't rely on their access. He has his own magnetic platform that's got millions and millions and millions of followers. And they're loyal. And everyone wants access to them, and he could just say no, just like that, one guy. And that is too much power, and that is why they're going after him constantly. Make no mistake, whatever you see posted, oh, Joe Rogan said this offensive, that, it's all BS. This is a guy who's a threat to a very, very powerful institution. And this woman with a blue check mark, well, if it's got a blue check mark, it's got to be important, right? She said, yesterday, your audience read blog posts. Today, your audience reads tweets. Whatever your message, learn to say it quickly. Maybe. Okay. Yes, businesses want answers quickly. So I don't think podcast necessarily is the best way to deliver it, unless it's super entertaining like mine. And also people who are trying to like fix their, you know, bike or figure out how to replace the headlamps on their car or whatever it is that they're doing, they want to get to it as quickly as possible. So if they have two videos, one is 4 minutes and the other is 14 minutes, they're going to pick the 4 minute video and then maybe do the other one if they don't understand it still. In those cases, yeah, expediency is important. But when it comes to understanding an issue in depth or understanding where a person is coming from, that requires depth. And sometimes it goes as long as it goes. So as long as it's interesting and as long as it's entertaining, it's fine. Keep going. So most things should be as long as they need to be. That's the bottom line. And so this time limit is artificial. It's like, I remember Howard Stern always used to make fun of this. I used to listen to him as a kid. And he would make fun of all these disc jockeys who had to do, welcome to KABC in the morning. It's 9:43. Like they had to give the time at a certain time. They had to give the weather. They had to do all the stuff. We have to go to news. We have to do. And it was all these interruptions. It was an atrocious experience because you couldn't get into the flow of conversations. You couldn't do anything in depth. And so that era is over. And I don't see any reason to bring it back because we have the option to choose. Look, and things are on a spectrum. Some things will need to be short and others won't. But I don't think you make that generalization that quickly. And Spotify, and talk about canceling Joe Rogan, supposedly their employees were upset with his show because he said some things that were maybe incorrect or politically incorrect. Andrew Schultz is a comedian who talked about this. He said, look, I don't even think this is real. I don't even think that these employees, because no one's interviewed these employees, are making that big of a stink. But this is part of this effort to cancel Joe. Look, I'm not worried about Joe. Joe, I'm sure, has an ironclad contract for a Spotify exclusive deal. But it's also an argument for why podcasters and other people, maybe comedians, have to stay independent and own their own relationship with their audience. And that includes writers who are writing on Substack too. Use these platforms strategically, but at the end of the day, you have to own your own audience because otherwise, if you're answering to a big corporation, you're exposed to all kinds of forces, external pressures, customer pressures, employee pressures. And so I think that everyone should read this. I wrote a piece called Surviving Platform Risk. Just Google it. It's on Idea Factory. Any kind of innovator, content creator, entrepreneur should read it. And the people I really worry about, are the people not who are making $100 million on their contract or more, but the people every day who have no leverage, who make one wrong move in their company or someone accuses them of something and they're gone, or they paint them with some sort of label. Those are the people I worry about. And this is happening more and more. That's where cancel culture is especially dark. There are companies in financial services, for example, that have a list of people that are unhirable. So no matter which company they go to, they cannot be hired. And how they got on that list, who's going to audit? But if they're on that list, they're done. So I think we really have to reconsider this authoritarianism and this desire to rob people of making a living. In fact, I think we should overcorrect in the other direction in protecting people under whether it's free speech or Civil Rights Act to be able to say what they want to say in their private lives, especially. And if these employees at Spotify actually are doing this, then I've got a message for them. Anytime you go against the business interests of your employer, even if the employer says, hey, it's okay to talk politics, you are the walking dead. And Google allegedly fired a bunch of people who led these employee protests and so on, or kind of, you know, squeezed them out or put them on the roof like they did in Silicon Valley. Don't think you're this free entity to be able to do whatever you want inside of a corporation. Inside of a corporation, you have to align with the interests of your employer. And if you start diverging or making them look bad, you are dead. Not literally, although we might get to a point where that happens too. But at this point, you are the walking dead. So don't get overly rambunctious, okay? And you could start your own business. You could join an organization that does this sort of thing or advocates for causes. Nothing wrong with that. But if you want to get those fat six-figure paychecks and still be a libertine, that's not going to happen. And the funny thing, I was thinking about Joe Rogan's podcast. His shows go 4, and I think there was one that went over 5 hours. You're basically living Joe's life in real time and not living yours. And it kind of reminded me of a Stephen Wright joke. I'm going to try to find the clip.
I have a map of the United States, its actual size. It says 1 mile equals 1 mile. People ask where I live, I say E5.
I love Stephen Wright. So I saw someone online posted that The Daily Show is looking for a podcast producer. So they're going to be pumping out a bunch of shows or podcasts. And it made me think that in the long term, mainstream media will defeat independent media, especially independent podcasts. And they're not going to do it with better product or better talent. What they're going to do is create a massive, endless flood of mediocrity, a bunch of, corporate-friendly fodder that just keeps coming out. Because remember, they have endless resources. They're going to keep pumping it out into the ether. And here's how it's going to work. Let's say Jill, she has a bunch of indie podcasts that she listens to, including The McFuture. And also some NPR stuff and maybe one or two professionally produced shows by, Comedy Central. She also loves Netflix and HBO and Hulu, watches movies and TV shows. Over time, the stars, the producers, the hosts, and the comics that she likes are going to start podcasts, because those podcast deals are going to be built into the overall deals that Hollywood has with these people. So it's not only, hey, you have to do this movie and you have to promote this movie, but now you have to do a podcast about this movie or an 8-episode series or interview or whatever. So all of this stuff is going to be bundled together. And you see already Hillary Clinton is doing podcasts. I mean, we couldn't listen to her when she was a candidate. Now she's going to do a podcast. I defy people to listen to that. Anyway, But over time, when there's so much of it and they have so much money to promote, they're going to steal little bits and pieces of Jill's listening time. So Jill, without even knowing it, is her feed is going to be overwhelmed by corporate content and not the indies that she once loved. So it's a natural thing that'll happen, but it will happen. I broke down the basic math of how this works. I'm not going to go through it now, but I think the steady state of, you know, just available listening time in the United States, we could support somewhere between 9,000 and 36,000 shows. And that doesn't mean others can't exist for hobbies with three or four listeners, but realistically, that's the number. I think we have probably like a million podcasts. Some of them are dead or whatever, not being updated. But the scale and the flood that can come is going to overwhelm whatever is there right now. And the formula is simple. It's volume, right? So lots of stuff. Plus time, because they can afford to do it over long periods of time. They have the capital, plus adjacent IP, because they have all of this intellectual property and all of these celebrities and all these characters that they can work with to pump into this category if they wanted to. I mean, still a fairly small category, but when things start to get to Joe Rogan level, it starts to attract people's attention. So it's not improbable that they'll do this. Word of mouth is still more powerful. When your friend recommends something or won't shut up about a certain podcast, hopefully the McFuture, you'll eventually check it out, sometimes at gunpoint. But capital is less effective, right? When you see a commercial, you're like, oh, they're trying to sell me something. But, you know, if you do it often enough, that repetition, you know, plants a seed in your brain. And next time you're in the store, whether it's a physical store or the app store, you're going to sign up or check it out. And all of this stuff wins over time. Plus, let's not forget, everyone has a price. Everyone has a price. And these companies can afford to pay it. Now, Joe Rogan went to a non-establishment player, but Viacom can afford to overpay and get the people that, you know, could be assets or could be threats and quiet them down or tame them a little bit and cut off those sharp edges. That can happen. That can very easily happen. Because remember, people now are afraid of being canceled. So if they get hired by a major organization, they might not be as radical. In fact, it's funny. A woman I invited on this show, on the McFuture, Patrice Cullors, who's the co-founder of Black Lives Matter, she just got a deal with, I think it was Warner Brothers, one of these companies, to get a production deal. Guess what you can't be when you have a production deal with Warner Brothers? Super radical. So this is a way of buying off the people who are threats. Why do you think they hired Reverend Al Sharpton? Because he's so amazing. He's got such a loyal following. No, because this is a guy who made a living threatening to sue people. And now they brought him on board and he's our friend, right? He's getting a paycheck from us. So guess what Al's not going to do? Al's not going to boycott your company and force you to do things you don't want to do. There's a podcast called The Fighter and the Kid. There are two guys who hosted it, Brian Callen and Brendan Schaub. They were having a successful podcast. They get tons of views online. And then what happens? Brian gets accused of some sort of sexual impropriety. I don't know the details of the case, but he denies it vehemently. And I think he's suing for defamation. And anyway, this is going to go on for a while. He disappeared from his show. And I'm like, why did he disappear from his show? Well, it turns out they sold their show and that company said, hey, we don't want to be associated with this guy, at least not for now. So there've been a bunch of guest hosts. So Brian was basically kicked off his own show because he was accused of something, not convicted, accused. Whenever you join an organization, this is kind of a theme here, you play by those rules or by the rules of this new society that we've created where an accusation is enough to take you down. Everyone has a price. Brian and Brendan had a price. They got that price. They licensed their show. And then when he needed a voice, it was gone. And they tried to do a separate show on Patreon. And I think they did a cease and desist or something where they kept them from doing it. So this is a problem. This is a legit problem in our society. And over time, companies like Disney will take over. Who knows? They might take over 80% of media at some point. They already own Hulu. They own ESPN, ABC. And Disney governing media is sort of like a priest governing your sex life. It's wholesome until things get really weird. And the expansion of Disney is also the contraction of the Overton window. The Overton window is used to describe what is the acceptable boundary of speech, of public dialogue and discourse. And that window is getting smaller and smaller. And guess what? When a conservative company, I know they have left-leaning public values, but it is a very conservative company because they cater to kids and families and so on. So they will contract that window even more. So everything will be about family and everything will be about protecting everybody. And guess what? Maybe that'll drive people to other alternatives. And who knows, maybe Disney will buy those up too. So we're sort of in the middle of this tug of war between independent thought and independent media and mainstream corporate media. And there's great ideas and great creators all around, but I fear the takeover of large media, because I think those independent voices are the ones that are upholding the spirit of free speech in this country. So I saw what I thought was the perfect tweet about Saturday Night Live by Ray Kump, who's a comedian and podcaster. SNL feels like a sketch that a corporation plays at a shareholder meeting right before the CEO announces that they've won their latest wrongful death suit. That cracked me up. Look, I am not a big fan of SNL anymore. I do check it out from time to time, and once in a while a good sketch comes up, but they're trying to play to the middle, and there is no middle anymore. People have their opinions. They have strong opinions. And look, to some extent, I'm trying to play to the middle, but I'm doing it offensively. Anyway, you know, I wrote, for example, a short parody of the debate between Kamala Harris and Mike Pence. That's not something that could ever appear on SNL because it's too edgy, because it makes fun of both sides. And we live in this world where you're supposed to pretend like you're making fun of the left, but really you could only make fun of the right, because that's just how media works right now for the most part, and how comedy works, unfortunately. And I don't believe in that. I think that if you can't find the humor in the other side, you're really not doing your job as a comedian or a commentator. Innocently, in 2009, I tweeted, "I wonder if there are any LinkedIn or Facebook Ponzi schemes. People who create fake profiles to connect with can't take anything for granted." Man, I was so innocent in 2009, but I saw this stuff coming. It was inevitable that trolls and opportunists and foreign actors would try to take advantage of these networks. I wasn't probably sure exactly how, but once you create something like this, it's inevitable. Check this out. San Francisco State University is hosting Leila Khalid. If you don't know that name, in 1970, she was part of a hijacking plot. Yes, she's an actual hijacker for El Al flight, which is a flight from Israel, flight 219. She tried to detonate a grenade on the plane. This is who is speaking at our universities. And Zoom is going to ban it. I'm very pro-free speech and against censorship. I honestly haven't formulated my opinion on whether actual terrorists should get to speak. Or at least I'm leaning no, because they've actually performed terror and implicitly advocated, although I don't know, they could have changed. So you know, I really don't have a strong opinion. I'd love to hear what people think on this, because if you've paid your price to society, and I don't know that she has, or if you've changed your mind, or if you're not advocating for something violent or a violent ideology, yeah, you should get to speak. I'm a little bit on the fence about this one. And I understand why Zoom's not doing this, because she is an actual terrorist. The New York Times Guild, which is the union for writers, went against its own writer, Bret Stephens, who dared question the 1619 Project, which basically says the roots of American history are all in slavery. And so he wrote an editorial. And listen, it's to the New York Times credit that they even published it. But it was very, very roundabout. It was almost like full of corporate speak, where he kind of had to talk in circles to get to his points. And maybe that's the way he writes. I don't read a lot of his columns. Glenn Greenwald said, "If you are eager to constrict the boundaries of expression, why would you choose journalism of all lines of work? It'd be like someone who believes space travel to be an immoral waste of resources opting to become an astronaut for NASA." Look, even if you disagree, you have to let the words out. You have to let people speak. And there's a thing going on in the New York Times especially, where they're against anything they're against being published. That's it. There is no more dialogue. And the subscription model contributes to that, because what people want when they subscribe to something, I thought it would be liberating, right? Oh, everyone could do whatever they want. No, it's not. What a subscription model actually does is it forces you to reinforce people's existing beliefs. And the minute you start violating those existing beliefs, they'll start unsubscribing. So now you're in the direct pleasuring business. So it turns out that corporate advertisers were actually a sort of a moderating force, where you couldn't get that extreme. But now, if all of your money or most of your money is coming from subscriptions, you're just pleasuring your audience. You know, yank, yank, yank. That is what you're doing. Facebook now says they're going to ban Holocaust denial under their new hate speech policy. Look, the Supreme Court has ruled that there's no such concept or no constitutional concept as hate speech. So hate speech becomes this malleable thing that you can define however you want. And I am fundamentally uncomfortable with it. I would rather give people the power to choose what they hear and what they don't hear. And I would also err on the side of hearing horrible opinions like this. And look, I'm a Jew. My grandfather died fighting Nazis. I get what Holocaust deniers are. I'm under no illusions. But I also don't want to send them underground to fester. And yes, you can make an argument that, yeah, they could recruit more people. Yeah, that's possible. But also, we won't know who they are because they're on some encrypted, decentralized service now. We need to be careful when we paint with broad strokes here, or when we use something as malleable as hate speech, because the thing that you think is great right now may one day end up under the hate speech category. Because remember, it's not always going to favor what you like. Erring on the side of letting people choose, giving them control over what they see and don't see, is a much better path, especially if we make an effort to educate people. As a perfect example of that, this is an excerpt from a Wall Street Journal article. This woman, Clara Jeffrey, wrote, "I am enraged. Excellent reporting from Wall Street Journal finds that Facebook engineers, with sign-off from Zuckerberg himself, retooled their algorithm to throttle traffic to high-value progressive news organizations like Mother Jones." So Mother Jones is a very progressive left-wing organization. They mucked around with the algorithm to deprioritize those posts for whatever reason. It could be under hate speech. It could be under, you know, political pressure, whatever it is. This is a problem, because this is what molds what you see what you do. It shapes your mind. It controls your emotions, because if it shows you a bunch of stuff that you negatively react to, you get become negative, or there's positive reinforcement. There's all kinds of manipulations happening, or what candidates you vote for, because they could show you more negative stuff about a certain candidate. This is very dangerous. This is the closest thing we've had to mind control. We've had advertising. I think that's kind of in the ballpark, because you bombard people with certain messages long enough and you start yelling, "Where's the beef? Where's the beef?" You know, like you start doing those stupid things. You don't even realize it's happening. In the 90s, everyone's going, "What's up?" You know, so I don't even know if they were doing it voluntarily. I think they were just grumbling it because they heard it so many times. So I think this is a new and much more insipid type of thought control. And I think we need to tamp it down somehow. Another example is this Hunter Biden story. So I don't know what's true. I have no idea. I'm not an investigative journalist. But New York Post published this article. And what Twitter did is it blocked people from posting that link. It blocked the entire New York Post account, and it blocked the account of the president's press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany. I don't know her how to pronounce her last name. Whatever it is, whatever is true or untrue, what this action by Twitter did is it showed how much power it has over public discourse. It brought attention to the story, more attention than if it just, you know, came and went. And it invited more scrutiny and probably regulation of social media. So it's going to have the exact opposite effect of whatever it is that they thought that they were doing by blocking it. And look, I'm sure there's legit reasons to scrutinize the story. And in fact, there's a whole bunch of media organizations that started debunking it or talking about what they know is untrue. And the excuse that they used is they said they're not going to post illicitly obtained materials. But wait a minute. Trump's tax returns, they were illicitly obtained, and the New York Times published those. Twitter didn't block anything. So obviously, this policy is not applied consistently. Same thing with WikiLeaks information. That stuff was released without permission of the DNC or whoever, and that was not constrained. So I think we need to be really careful about how much power these companies have. And right now they have protections under Section 230, which basically says, hey, no matter what's posted, because they're platforms, they're shielded from any legal wrongdoing, like libel or any of those similar actions, or someone goes kill somebody. Clearly this is not working. Because they have such a powerful impact, we need to consider other actions. And personally, as a Ukrainian, I've never tried to influence Joe Biden. But as an American, I've also never had a blizzard at Dairy Queen. I have failed two nations. And the Babylon Bee, it's like the Onion for conservatives. They're getting all these demonetization threats on YouTube. They're getting all these sober pieces written up on New York Times. They're getting warning labels put on their stories. It is clearly satire. But the guy, I guess he's the founder of it, Kyle Mann, posted that he's getting all of this crazy stuff. New York Times did this feature like, oh, you know, what are you doing? What's your impact on the election? And these guys are being screwed around with. So this is how much power Silicon Valley has to move the needle on an election. If you happen to like the people they're supporting right now, they've been big supporters in the past of Kamala Harris. They're supporting Joe Biden. If you're a fan of them, you're like, yeah, do that. Yeah, go girl. But don't think just because they're on your side today, they will continue to be. They're ultimately in it for their own interests. They're in it for whoever gives them the policies that they want. Don't be a premature celebrator. Even in general, I did a survey. How long will social platforms, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, host prominent critics of their own platforms? So I asked forever, because it looks bad if you ban them. Host but subtly downrank them, so just make it visible to fewer people. Or you boot them under BS pretenses like they did with the New York Post story. Or overtly boot them and say, hey, you violated our terms of service. 80% of people said they're going to continue to host them, but they're just going to squelch them like they're doing to my account. I don't know what happened to my account, but it's been frozen and people tell me they don't see my tweets. Whatever. Now you're going to see it through other means. But this is a real problem. And 80% of people, at least on this survey, believe that they're going to just sweep you under the rug. You'll be there. The rug will look a little lumpy, but you still got a rug. So here's my solution to this. I thought about what are the most important parameters for deciding whether social networks should enjoy the protections of platforms. Because if you continue to make decisions about who gets to have an account and who doesn't, who gets banned and who doesn't, who gets muted and who doesn't, and also you get to decide which stories are shown or not shown or prioritized, then you're an editor. You're editorializing like a newspaper. So you should be accountable for those decisions. And that's the argument of the Trump administration. And I think some Democrats also agree with this. So look, I think it's a problem. I've given you some examples on the left and the right, which are pretty egregious. So I think the two things that should determine it are, first, are you banning people beyond any kind of legal mandate? Yes or no? And the second, are you doing any kind of post-selection? Right, choosing what people see or don't see, whether it's algorithmic, because remember, a person still programs the algorithm, or whether it's individuals who are curating or saying no to certain things that are flagged. So if you're doing both, if you're choosing posts and you're choosing people who get to talk or get to have accounts on your platform, then you shouldn't have those protections. You're an editorial entity. Now, if you don't ban people, but do choose the posts, you should have no protection either. That's still editorialization. If you don't do either, right? If anyone can have an account and any post can be shown and it's just chronological or whatever the user chooses to block or not block, then you should be protected. The only tricky one here is when you ban people, but you don't squelch posts. And in that case, I think what should happen is, as long as there are clear rules of what gets you banned and there's a redemption policy, a way for you to make it right and come back, as long as both of those conditions exist and you don't editorialize or choose posts, you should have the protections. A former Facebook executive said the following: "The social media services that I and others have built over the past 15 years have served to tear people apart. At worst, I fear we are pushing ourselves to the brink of civil war." And that was said by Tim Kendall, Facebook's first director of monetization. Now, let me tell you, when Facebook's first director of monetization got shivved in the yard by Facebook's first director of polarization, he knew shit just got real. That's a goofy title. First director of monetization, as if they were planning to execute him at some point. It's like being married and going to a dinner party and saying, "I meet my first wife, Karen." And Karen's like, "What? What do you mean first wife? I thought I was the wife." We should talk after. Everyone blames Facebook for something, or even Twitter. They're saying it's undermining democracy. I've said that probably in this show. It's silencing free speech. I've said that too. No one sees my posts unless I pay. I've said that too, although they won't even let me pay. I blame the blamers to some extent. On some level, we have to take accountability for this. It's like the airlines, you know, when the flight attendant goes up there and says, "You have a choice of many airlines. So we appreciate you chose us, Air Death." And I'm like, dude, Air Death is the only one that flies between the two cities I need to go to. You've got an exclusive route. What choice do I have? There's a little bit of that with Facebook, but some of it is a choice. And I think more and more people are seeing them for the tricksters that they are, and either taking it with a grain of salt, seriously reducing usage like I'm doing, or just completely leaving. And I think that makes sense. Ultimately, we have to get to a point where we can empower individuals to make those choices themselves. But there's a danger in empowering individuals because you're not going to like the choices that they make sometimes, especially if they're uninformed or they're desperate. You know, look at Arab Spring. Everyone was celebrating this liberation. Oh my God, we're all free. We've got democracies. 5 minutes later, they vote in new despots because that's what they wanted. They weren't ready for democracy. You can't foist it upon people. It has to be organic. But there's nothing organic about the way social networks work. Yes, the idea of social networking and that behavior is organic, but not what happens once you're being manipulated inside their matrix. TikTok has removed 104 million videos in the first half of 2020 because they said they're harmful or they have some sort of bad content. And they are proposing a coalition of social networks to ban certain users or certain accounts. And this kind of reminded me of a consortium that Kaspersky had. So Kaspersky, if you don't know, is a Russian antivirus company. Now, supposedly they have really good protection, but when you install antivirus on your computer, it gets deep into the operating system. It sees everything that goes through your computer. So it's a very strategic asset that I doubt Russia would just let be free. That, personally, I have no proof. Actually, I do have proof. There's been a bunch of accusations against Kaspersky. One accusation in particular was they have this common database with all of the other antivirus companies. And so what Kaspersky started doing, allegedly, is they started putting false positives into the system. So the other antivirus companies started deleting important system files. So people's systems started crashing and people were like, oh my God, what's going on? My computer's not restarting because they put false positives into the system. Kaspersky has denied it. But at this point, just as a sidebar, use Windows Defender if you're a Windows user, because at least Microsoft, you know, I don't know who has access to their data, but at least they're also the provider of the operating system, so they already know what's going on in your machine. But this social media common malware database opens you up to the same kind of malicious behavior. Now, personally, I think all posts on social media should be fact-checked by Ghislaine Maxwell. Ghislaine, come. See all of our secrets on social media. You're the only one we can trust. We know you'll never talk. The entire Twitter network went down this week. No one could tweet. This was a disaster. The president was apoplectic. I can't even spell apoplectic. I can't even say apoplectic. And I'm sure that's what he was. And Twitter would not admit the truth here. It took its entire network offline because it didn't want you to know the truth, that they've been throttling my account to keep my radical pragmatist militia, Proud Tifa, from seizing power. That is the real truth. I'm actually thinking of rebranding my pragmatist militia. I'm thinking of something like Pragtifa or Sensiballers or Scientologist. It's still a work in progress, clearly. From the burbs, Twitter reminds me of Arthur C. Clarke's book, Songs of Distant Earth, where humans colonized a distant planet. They basically seeded it with embryos, and they were living these idyllic lives. It was paradise. Until one day, a ship arrived with refugees from the last days of Earth. And with it, they brought conflict and pettiness that poisoned paradise. And that's kind of what Twitter is. It's not that we were at paradise before, but we were certainly at blissful ignorance and really moving in the right direction in terms of aligning ourselves behind America, not behind identities, and not squabbling over stupid things or trying to cancel people. I think we've introduced a sort of darkness into our lives that I hope we're able to extricate or exorcise. And I don't mean like, I mean exorcise like demons. But at the end of the day, if you never engage with any of this nonsense, it all goes away. You go back to living a normal, angst-free private life, then why don't you? Then why don't I? What is it that compels us? Why are we there? Now that we're done, go ahead and sign up for the Patreon. Go to patreon.com/McFuture. You'll get tons of awesome bonuses, but more important, you'll be saving the world from utter disaster. And it's just me and you, you and me together saving the world. The world. See you next time on the McFuture.